content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the November 18th, 2022 issue of The Week. The cover drawing this week is a beach scene. The Republican elephant is standing on the shore. He's got on his swim trunks, and under his right arm is a surfboard. He's looking out at the water, kind of concerned. The water's fairly flat. There's a tiny little breaker on the shore with a lot of red in the water. And the headline is, "Where's the Wave? Why Republicans' Midterm Gains Fell Short of Expectations." That is our first main story, and we'll start with that. The GOP's red trickle. What happened? Democrats defied both expectation and historical precedent this week as a widely anticipated Republican red wave in the midterm elections failed to materialize, leaving control of both the House and Senate in question as the week went to press. Still, as votes in dozens of key races were counted, the GOP was favored to take control of the House by a narrow margin, and a Senate win was still within reach. Democrats scored a key win in Pennsylvania, where John Fetterman, hampered by a stroke that affected his ability to respond to oral questions, beat Donald Trump-endorsed celebrity doctor Mehmet Oz, flipping a Republican seat. That left Senate control hinging on three races that were too close to call a day after the polls closed, with each party needing to win two. In contention were Arizona, where incumbent Democrat Mark Kelly led Trump-endorsed venture capitalist Blake Masters, Nevada, where Republican Adam Laxalt held the edge over incumbent Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto, and Georgia, which was headed for a runoff after neither Republican Herschel Walker nor Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock reached the 50% of the vote required for an outright win. Republicans were favored to win the House as votes were still being counted Wednesday, but by a far slimmer majority than most predicted. Numerous Democrats thought to be vulnerable held their seats against hard-right GOP candidates, and the Democrats flipped GOP seats in Ohio and Michigan. Meanwhile, the GOP took formerly Democratic seats in Florida, New Jersey, Virginia, and New York. As of late Wednesday, the Democrats held 183 seats and Republicans 206, with 46 races undecided and 218 seats needed for House control. "It was definitely not a Republican wave," said Senator Lindsey Graham. "That's for darn sure." In exit polls by NBC News and Edison Research, nearly a third of voters cited inflation as their biggest concern, while about a quarter said it was abortion. Only 1 in 10 cited crime or immigration as their chief concern. What the columnist said. "The red wave ended up a red trickle," said Declan Garvey and Esther Eaton in the Dispatch. Republicans went into Tuesday's election incredibly bullish, with Biden's approval ratings underwater and inflation at levels not seen since the early 1980s. Add the fact that the president's party almost always crashes and burns in the midterms, and the stage was set for the Republicans to gain 40 or 50 House seats and flip the Senate. Instead, Democrats made the strongest showing by an incumbent president party since 2002. "It turns out candidate quality matters," said Tiana Lowe in the Washington Examiner. "This should have been a blowout for Republicans, given voter concerns about crime and inflation. But the party was saddled with hapless candidates like Oz, a multimillionaire television star who actually lives in New Jersey, and Walker, an addled celebutant and supposed pro-lifers who's been accused by two women for paying for abortions. These candidates' only credential was bending the knee to Trump." Republicans hoped the midterms would be a straight-up referendum on the president, said William Salatin in the Bulwark. But in exit polls, 47% said he didn't factor into their House picks. Many voters made their choices based on specific issues and the candidates actually on the ballot. What did matter was abortion, said Matthew Iglesias in his slow, boring newsletter. Midterm voters normally vote against the president's party because they want checks on its power. But the biggest policy overreach of the past 2 years was the conservative Supreme Court majority overturning Roe v. Wade, which angered women and young voters in particular. Republicans, who then moved to ban abortion in over a dozen states, just went too far. It turns out that people don't like having their rights taken away. It was a bad night for Trump, said David Siders in Politico, and his place in the party is far weaker as a result. His handpicked candidates fared poorly, from Walker to Don Bolduc, who was blown out in New Hampshire by incumbent Maggie Hassan. But Republican governors Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott scored dominant victories in Florida and Texas, and solid GOP majorities there have those states off the table for Democrats for the foreseeable future. Democrats fared far better than almost anybody expected, said Jonathan Chait in New York Magazine, and it was mostly because voters had no confidence in the alternative. Republicans tried to exploit Trump's hallucinatory grievance narrative by running unqualified extremist candidates, but voters decided that Trumpist looms like Oz, Walker, and Bolduc were unlikely to fix what's broken. Unfortunately for the GOP, it turns out there's still a robust constituency in this country for leaders who are not overly crazy. A second, shorter main story related. Voters back abortion protections, turned down bans. What happened? Still energized by anger over the overturning of Roe v. Wade last summer, voters this week approved measures enshrining the right to abortion access in three state constitutions and rejected proposals that would further curtail abortion in two conservative strongholds. California and Vermont residents overwhelmingly approved proposals to add explicit language to their constitutions protecting the right to reproductive choice. Voters in Michigan, where a court had already nullified a 1931 abortion ban that remained on the books, approved a similar constitutional change. Kentuckians rejected a constitutional amendment explicitly denying any right to abortion, a surprise result in a deeply conservative state where a trigger ban went into effect immediately after Roe's June 24th repeal. In Montana, voters appeared to reject a born-alive provision that would require health care providers to try to save the lives of infants born with fatal conditions or fetuses that survive abortions. Election Day exit polling suggested that abortion was an important factor in voting decisions across the ballot. 6 out of 10 voters surveyed by Reuters said the Supreme Court's overturning of the right to abortion left them dissatisfied or angry, and about 3 out of 10 identified it as their top concern in the election, equaling the number who chose inflation. President Biden recently promised to send a bill protecting abortion access nationwide to Congress in January to coincide with the 50th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. But with Republicans poised to gain a slim House majority, it is unlikely to pass. What the columnist said, 3 months after Kansas surprised the political world by rejecting an abortion ban, said Aaron Blake in the Washington Post, more states are following its lead. Democrats have used the overturning of Roe as turnout fuel, but it mattered to more than just the base. Montana and Kentucky revealed support for abortion in red states, and the issue helped Democrats to a 49-47 lead among independent voters. The public's views on abortion are complicated, said Matthew Continetti in the Washington Free Beacon. They generally reject laws that deem either too permissive or restrictive. Pro-life Republicans did fine in Florida, Ohio, and Georgia, but in other places, such as the Virginia district that reelected Democratic Representative Abigail Spanberger, the issue may have been decisive. Republicans should take lessons in talking about the right to life instead of assuming it's a self-evident moral good. Many pundits have treated abortion as a marginal women's issue, said Laura Bassett in Jezebel. It's seen as peripheral to more important matters like the economy. But in race after race, including the crucial Senate contest in Pennsylvania, voters showed that's not true. Months of horrifying stories that have emerged about patients who were denied abortions, even in cases of child rape and life-threatening health problems, have starkly illustrated just how much is at stake. Voters do not want politicians to take that choice away. Controversy of the week, Trump versus DeSantis, how the midterms may affect 2024. He's back, said the New York Daily News in an editorial. Donald Trump has told supporters to expect a very special announcement next week, strongly hinting he will make another run at the presidency in 2024. He made his intentions clear in a series of heavy-handed jabs at Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, whose landslide re-election this week solidified his status as Trump's most plausible rival for the Republican presidential nomination. At a Pennsylvania rally, Trump debuted a nickname for his rival, Ron DeSanctimonious, and later warned on Fox News that if DeSantis does choose to run, I would tell you things about him that won't be very flattering, with the creepy addendum that I know more about him than anybody, other than perhaps his wife. These shameful remarks are a sign of weakness, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. In the midterms, a host of Trump-endorsed MAGA candidates lost Senate and gubernatorial races, while DeSantis' 20-point victory in Florida was three times the size of Trump's state-winning margin in 2020. This is a clear signal to Republicans desperate for an alternative to Trump, then the future of the GOP has arrived in the person of Ron DeSantis. DeSantis seems to agree, said Gabrielle Sherman in Vanity Fair. He's already spent some of his $180 million campaign war chest on a grandiose TV ad literally depicting him as chosen by God as a protector, a message clearly aimed at a national audience. But sources say he's telling donors he isn't inclined to fight Trump for the 2024 nomination. At only 44, why should DeSantis risk a bruising slugfest with Trump when he can govern Florida for four more years and cruise to the nomination in 2028? For Republican leaders and the conservative intelligentsia, the lesson of these midterms is that it's time to reject Trumpism, said Jonathan Last in The Bulwark. But that puts them in an agonizing quandary. How does conservatism, Inc., undermine Trump and elevate DeSantis without enraging Trump and splitting the party? Good luck with that. DeSantis would be foolish to defer to Trump, said Nick Cottagio in the Dispatch. If he waits to make his presidential run until 2028, he'll have to run without the trappings of office. His term as governor ends in 2026, and there's every chance that by then he'll have been replaced as Trump's heir apparent by some populist goblin we might not even heard of yet. If DeSantis, fresh off a landslide, stands meekly aside to let a 76-year-old, twice-impeached, soon-to-be-indicted insurrectionist claim the Republican nomination without a fight, he will cease to be a plausible presidential contender. It's unclear whether DeSantis will run in 2024, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times, but he's already shown Republicans how they can win. the scale of his victory this week, becoming the first Republican in two decades to win Miami-Dade County, suggests there's a decisive right-of-center majority there for the taking in American politics. By someone who can fuse a muscular, Trump-like cultural pugilism with an aura of competence and steady leadership. After the beating Trump's MAGA slate took this week, said Jonathan Swan in Axios, his chances of running unopposed for the 2024 nomination are greatly diminished. Rival candidates, GOP donors, and party leaders have caught the invigorating scent of blood in the water. Time for our good week, bad week segment. It was a good week for investors who shorted Tesla. After CEO Elon Musk sold another $3.95 billion in Tesla shares to shore up his disastrous Twitter purchase, Tesla's stock is down nearly 50% this year and has lost $600 billion in market capitalization since its peak. It was a good week for fantasies after a struggling scuba diver off the coast of California was rescued by a group of women divers who dress as mermaids, complete with tails. It was something out of a fairy tale, being saved by a mermaid, said the saved diver, Javier Claremont. It was a good week for selling handsome, with the launch of Le Domaine, a line of skincare products from actor Brad Pitt. In a review of the serum in New York Post, Brian Fast said that for its $385 price tag, Brad Pitt should come to your house and apply it to your face. But it was a bad week for it being a small world, after all, when a fugitive on the run from New York City authorities for more than a year was spotted, tackled, and arrested at Florida's Walt Disney World by the same federal agent who signed his warrant. Quashawn Burton, 31, was given away by the distinctive H tattooed on his neck. It was a bad week for distancing after a COVID outbreak somehow swept through workers at the McMurdo Research Station in Antarctica, infecting 98 workers. The station is being closed to visitors, and workers are asked to isolate and wear N95 masks. And it was a bad week for wide open spaces after a resident of remote, sparsely populated Nevada County, California, had his home destroyed by a meteorite. They say it's a 1 in 4 trillion chance, shrugged Dustin Proshita. So I guess I might be buying a lottery ticket today. Briefing this week is the growing danger of political violence. Threats of politically motivated violence and actual attacks are soaring. Why is this happening? When did the violence surge? Politically motivated violence has waxed and waned throughout American history, but the current upsurge began with the election of Donald Trump as president in 2016. Since Trump took office, threats against members of Congress have increased tenfold, with 9,625 incidents reported last year. The FBI has tripled its domestic terrorism budget, and the U.S. Justice Department has created task forces to investigate the intimidation of public officials. A man steeped in MAGA rhetoric and QAnon online conspiracy theories recently broke into the San Francisco home of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, hoping to cripple her with a hammer. When she was not there, he fractured her husband's skull. In the past year, right-wing militia members in Michigan were convicted of plotting to kidnap the Democratic governor, Gretchen Whitmer, and an armed man was arrested outside Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh's home. An armed Trump supporter was killed in August after he tried to shoot his way into an FBI office in Cincinnati. I wouldn't be surprised if a senator or House member were killed, said Senator Susan Collins, a Republican from Maine. What started with abusive phone calls is now translating into active threats of violence and real violence. Who's committing the violence? There are threats and acts of violence from the left, but evidence shows that most perpetrators are right-wing extremists. Of more than 440 extremism-linked murders in the past decade, more than three-quarters were committed by right-wing extremists or white supremacists, according to the Anti-Defamation League. Last year, 26 of 29 political homicides were committed by right-wing extremists. Since 2015, right-wing extremists have been involved in 269 plots and attacks, compared with 66 for left-wing extremists, according to a study from the Center for Strategic and International Studies. A University of Maryland study of political violence since 1948 found that despite famous attacks in the 1960s and 70s from left-wing radicals such as the Weather Underground, right-wing violence was nearly twice as prevalent. The deadliest act of domestic terrorism in U.S. history came in 1995 when right-wing extremist Timothy McVeigh bombed a federal building in Oklahoma City and killed 168 people. On January 6, 2021, a mob of hundreds of Trump supporters broke into the U.S. Capitol to try to stop the certification of Joe Biden's victory, injuring more than 110 police officers and chasing lawmakers into hiding. What about left-wing violence? It occurs, though less frequently. In 2017, a supporter of Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders opened fire at a GOP congressional baseball practice, gravely wounding Representative Steve Scalise of Louisiana. The 2020 Black Lives Matter protest in response to a police officer's murder of George Floyd were mostly peaceful, but arson, looting, and vandalism in several cities caused an estimated $2 billion in damage. The far-left Antifa movement has engaged in violent confrontations with police and right-wing groups, especially in Portland, Oregon, where an Antifa activist killed a Trump supporter in 2020. Who's being targeted? Officials at all levels of government. A Seattle man was charged with showing up at Democratic Representative Pramila Jayapal's house with a handgun in July, shouting threats and profanities. Republican Representative Brian Mast of Florida received nearly 500 calls in 2018 from a man threatening to kill Mast's children. The Justice Department says this year alone, more than 1,000 threats have been reported against election workers. In Congress, many lawmakers are beefing up their personal security. Senator Raphael Warnock, the Democrat from Georgia, has spent nearly $900,000 for his own protection, while Senator Ted Cruz has spent nearly $600,000. Every morning, staffers compile a folder with photos of people who threatened Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez so she might recognize them. I just don't know how seriously people are going to take this unless someone gets hurt, Ocasio-Cortez said. What have political leaders said? Democrats have consistently condemned perpetrators of political violence, while many Republicans have not. The attack on Pelosi's husband, for example, became the subject of cruel jokes and conspiracy theories in conservative media and among some Republican candidates and officials. After that attack, Representative Adam Kinzinger, the Republican from Illinois, a GOP pariah since voting for Trump's impeachment, told his fellow Republicans, "When you convince people that politicians are rigging elections, drink babies' blood, etc., you will get violence." Guns and threats are increasingly common in GOP ads. In one video, Representative Ken Buck, Republican from Colorado, brandishes a rifle, daring President Biden to come and take it. After Representative Paul Gosar, Republican from Arizona, posted an animated video showing himself slaying Ocasio-Cortez and attacking Biden, just two Republicans in the House voted to censure him. "We are a tinderbox right now," said Robert Pape, a political scientist at the University of Chicago. "The difference between the right and the left is you are getting lightning strikes on the right. It is just happening again and again." Moving into the best columns of the week, we'll start with the corrosive power of resentment. "Resentment is perhaps the most powerful political force in the modern world," said Tom Nichols. In a recent tweet, the Republican House Judiciary Committee celebrated three men: Kanye, Elon, Trump. "It is deeply revealing these very disparate characters have become right-wing heroes, because what they have in common is their resentment of a dominant elite culture that still refuses to grant them the respect they think is their due. Kanye West, or Ye, is convinced his incredible genius is unappreciated, especially by the fashion world. Trump has spent his life as the outer borough mook with the nose pressed to the windows of Midtown Manhattan. Frustrated, he's scorned by other successful people and can't get positive coverage in the New York Times. The puerile Musk blew $44 billion to buy Twitter to torment those who view him as a spoiled rich doofus. For Trump, Musk, and fellow populist demagogues like Steve Bannon, politics is merely the instrument of revenge. They channel and whip up the resentments of the white working class and culture warriors who revere them, with a toxic impact on politics and democracy. Today, social and cultural resentment is driving millions of people into a kind of mass psychosis. Biden isn't fit to run again. While we were all distracted by the recent avalanche of political news, said George Will, President Biden provided an alarming evidence that his mental faculties are slipping. He should not seek another term. In a recent meeting with progressive activists, Biden said his $426 billion student loan forgiveness edict came through a law he had just signed, and that it passed by a vote or two. This is not just another Biden gaffe. No law was passed, and Biden unilaterally implemented the windfall in an attempt to woo young voters. It's frightening that Biden doesn't know or remember that, and it's not an isolated case. He recently said his son, Beau, died while serving in Iraq. He died 6 years later. The Washington Post fact checker has awarded Biden the bottomless Pinocchio rating for another lie. Vice President Kamala Harris is no better, making speeches of eerie strangeness with statements like these: "We have a secure border in that it is a priority for any nation, including ours and our administration." Enough. In 2024, the Republican Party might present the nation with a presidential nominee whose unfitness has been demonstrated. Democrats should not imperil the nation by doing likewise. This column comes from Uganda. The victims of African development. Be skeptical of the claim that African countries must be allowed to pollute in order to grow, said Rachel Tugumi, With the latest UN climate summit underway, African governments are loudly arguing that just as the West burned coal and oil for decades, they too should get to exploit the resources and develop their economies. As a Ugandan farmer who lost her land to an oil pipeline, I wonder whose socioeconomic transformation they're really talking about. I live in Hoima, where I grow cassava as a staple food and a cash crop. The $240 a year my field earns helps meet my family's basic needs and pay school fees for my two children. But in 2019, the French corporation Total Energies, developer of the planned East African crude oil pipeline, ordered me not to plant crops because a cutoff date had been placed on our property. 3 years later, construction still hasn't started, but I'm out hundreds, and whatever compensation I eventually get for my land won't repay the loss. Other Ugandan cassava and coffee growers face the same injustice. As farmers, we are already suffering climate change impacts. Now we know that oil projects also come with increased poverty. Whose economic development will oil serve? Certainly not ours. It's time for The Last Word, our feature article, titled this week, Real Progress on Climate Change. Humankind is on a path to avoid the worst-case climate catastrophe, said David Wallace Wells in the New York Times Magazine, but we're still deciding how bad it gets. You can never really see the future, only imagine it. Then try to make sense of the new world when it arrives. Just a few years ago, climate projections for this century looked quite apocalyptic, with most scientists warning that continuing business as usual would bring the world 4 or even 5 degrees Celsius of warming, a change disruptive enough to call forth not only predictions of food crises and heat stress, state conflict and economic strife, but also, from some corners, warnings of civilizational collapse and even sort of a human endgame. Now, with the world already 1.2 degrees hotter, scientists believe that warming this century will most likely fall between 2 or 3 degrees. A little lower is possible with much more concerted action, a little higher, too, with slower action and bad climate luck. Those numbers may sound abstract, but what they suggest is this. Thanks to astonishing declines in the price of renewables, a truly global political mobilization, a clearer picture of the energy future, and serious policy focus from world leaders, we have cut expected warming almost in half in just 5 years. For decades, visions of possible climate futures have been anchored by, on the one hand, Pollyanna-like faith that normality would endure, and on the other, millenarian intuitions of an ecological end of days, during which perhaps billions of lives would be devastated or destroyed. More recently, these two stories have been mapped onto climate modeling. Conventional wisdom has dictated that meeting the most ambitious goals of the Paris Agreement by limiting warming to 1.5 degrees could allow for some continuing normal. But failing to take rapid action on emissions and allowing warming above 3 or even 4 degrees spelled doom. Neither of those futures looks all that likely now, with the most terrifying predictions made improbable by decarbonization and the most hopeful ones practically foreclosed by tragic delay. Over the last several months, I've had dozens of conversations with climate scientists and economists and policymakers, advocates, and activists, and novelists and philosophers about the new world and the ways we might conceptualize it. I find myself returning to three sets of guideposts which help map the landscape of possibility. First, worst-case temperature scenarios that recently seemed plausible now look much less so, which is arguably good news and, in a time of climate panic and despair, a truly underappreciated sign of genuine and world-shaping progress. Second, and just important, the likeliest futures still lie beyond thresholds long thought disastrous, marking a failure of global efforts to limit warming to safe levels. Through decades of only minimal action, we have squandered that opportunity. Perhaps even more concerning, the more we are learning about even relatively moderate levels of warming, the harsher and harder to navigate they seem. Third, humanity retains an enormous amount of control over just how hot it will get and how much we will do to protect one another through those assaults and disruptions. Acknowledging that truly apocalyptic warming now looks considerably less likely than it did just a few years ago pulls the future out of the realm of myth and returns it to the plane of history. Contested, combative, combining suffering and flourishing, though not in equal measure for every group. How did we get to this point from the bleakest scenarios for climate collapse? To begin with, the world started to shift away from coal. Almost no one outside the insular world of energy nerds appreciates just how drastic and rapid the cost declines of renewable technologies have been. A story almost as astonishing and perhaps as consequential as the invention within weeks and rollout within months of new mRNA vaccines to combat a global pandemic. Since 2010, the cost of solar power and lithium battery technology has fallen by more than 85%, the cost of wind power by more than 55%. The International Energy Agency recently predicted that solar power would become the cheapest source of electricity in history, and a report by Carbon Tracker found that 90% of the global population lives in places where new renewable power would be cheaper than new dirty power. The world looks almost as different for politics and policy. 5 years ago, almost no one had heard of Greta Thunberg or the Fridays for Future school strikers, Extinction Rebellion, or the Sunrise Movement. There wasn't serious debate about the Green New Deal or the European Green Deal. Today, more than 90% of the world's GDP and over 80% of global emissions are now governed by net zero pledges of various kinds, each promising thorough decarbonization at historically unprecedented speeds. At this point, they are mostly paper pledges, few of them binding enough in the short term to look like real action plans rather than strategies of smiling delay. And yet it still marks a new era for climate action that a vast majority of world leaders have felt pressed to make them by the force of protest, public anxiety, and voter pressure, and increasingly by the powerful logic of national self-interest. The good news is we have implemented policies that are significantly bringing down the projected global average temperature change, says the Canadian atmospheric scientist Catherine Hayhoe, a lead chapter author on several national climate assessments, and an evangelical Christian who has gained a reputation as a sort of climate whisperer to the center right. The bad news, she says, is that we have been systematically underestimating the rate and magnitude of extremes. Even if temperatures rise a limited 2 degrees, she said, the extremes might be what you would have projected for 4 or 5. We're not at even 1.5 now, and a third of Pakistan is underwater, right? says the Nigerian-American philosopher Olufemi Otaiwo, who has spent much of the last few years writing about climate justice in the context of reparations for slavery and colonialism. What we're seeing now at less than 2 degrees, there's nothing optimistic about that. The world is moving faster to decarbonize than it once seemed responsible to imagine, and yet not nearly fast enough to avert real turbulence. Even the straightest path to 2 degrees looks tumultuous, with disruptions from the natural world sufficient to call into question many of the social and political continuities that have been taken for granted for generations. What will the world look like at 2 degrees? There will be extreme weather, even more intense and much more frequent. Disruption and upheaval at some scale, at nearly every level, from the microbial to the geopolitical. Suffering and injustice for hundreds of millions of people, because the benefits of industrial activity have accumulated in parts of the world that will also be spared the worst of its consequences. At 2 degrees in many parts of the world, floods that used to hit once a century would come every single year, and those that came once a century would be beyond all historical experience. Wildfire risk would grow, and wildfire smoke too. Extreme heat events could grow more than 3 times more likely globally, and the effects would be uneven. In India, by the end of the century, there would be 30 times as many severe heat waves as today, according to one estimate. 93 times as many people would be exposed to dangerous heat. This is what now counts as progress. In some places, climate rhetoric has begun to soften, or perhaps it is better to say harden, with existential abstractions thickening into something more like high-stakes realism. Thunberg, the unyielding face of climate alarm, recently affirmed her support for at least existing nuclear power, and Rupert Reed, once a spokesman for Extinction Rebellion, has taken to calling for a moderate flank of the climate movement. In the United States, the climate bill that emerged finally into law was not a Green New Deal, a punitive carbon tax, or a program of demand reduction, but an expansive, incentive-based approach to decarbonizing that included support for nuclear power and even carbon capture, long an anathema to the climate left. This may look like a growing consensus, which to a certain extent it is, but the world it points to is still a quite unresolved mess. The danger is that you have a world that runs on sun and wind, but is still essentially a broken planet, the author and activist Bill McKibben says. Now the most pressing question is whether it can be fixed, whether we can manage those disruptions and protect the many millions of people who might be hurt by them. The political discourse orbiting these issues is known loosely as climate justice. To what extent will climate change harden and deepen already unconscionable levels of global inequality? And to what degree can the countries of the global South engineer and exit from the already oppressive condition that the scholar Faraha Sultana has called climate coloniality? The big thing politically that's going to happen on a massive scale is movement, says Taiwo, the philosopher. The numbers I've seen for displacement, both internal displacement and cross-border displacement at 2 degrees, are at least in the tens, if not hundreds of millions. And I don't think we have a political context for what that means. Taiwo says his mind drifts intuitively toward one scenario. If the far right wins, he says, I see copycat agencies that are much like ICE operating in much of the global north and in some emerging states. I see a gradual integration of domestic policing and, for lack of a better term, border policing, which I think we're seeing now anyway, a much more openly authoritarian development of those institutions, increasingly operating autonomously. But maybe there's another version of what that mix of pressures looks like at 2 degrees Celsius, Taiwa says. One that produces more local resilience and sustainability, along with innovation in energy and politics, agriculture and culture. And partially because of the success of a few of these measures, he says. You get markedly lower than predicted displacement numbers. In 2017, when I wrote a long and bleak magazine article about worst-case scenarios for the climate, I didn't think the political mobilization of the last 5 years was even possible. If you had told me then about the radical acceleration of renewable technology to come, I would have been more credulous, but still surprised. But signs of optimism are not arguments for complacency. Quite the opposite. Because the new range of expectations is not just a marker of how much has changed over the last 5 years, but of how much might over the next 5, the next 25, or the next 50. 2 degrees is not inevitable. Both better and worse outcomes are possible. But we are getting a clearer map of climate change, and however intimidating it looks, that new world must be made navigable through action to limit the damage and adaptation to defend against what can't be stopped. At 4 degrees, the impacts of warming appeared overwhelming, but at 2 degrees, the impacts would not be the whole of our human fate, only the landscape on which a new future will be built. Normalization is a form of adaptation, too, however cruel and unfortunate a form it may appear in theory or ahead of time. Indeed, already we can say a given heat wave was made 30 times more likely by climate change, or that it was a few degrees hotter than it would have been without climate change, and both would be true. We'll be able to talk about the contributions of warming to disasters that buckle whole nations, as the recent monsoon flooding in Pakistan has, or about the human contributions to such vulnerability. And as we do today, we will often reach for the past when trying to judge the present, reckoning with how the world got where it is and who was responsible and whether the result of the fight against warming counts as progress or failure or both. We've come a long way, and we've still got a long ways to go, said Hayhoe, the Canadian scientist, comparing the world's progress to a long hike. We're halfway there. Look at the great view behind you. We actually made it up halfway, and it was a hard slog. So take a breather, pat yourself on the back, but then look up. That's where we have to go. So let's keep on going. This was adapted from an article that originally appeared in the New York Times Magazine. On the Talking Points page with a couple of articles. First, Irving, a hateful conspiracy theory. Brooklyn Nets star Kyrie Irving is an anti-vaxxer known for embracing wacky conspiracy theories, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. But this time he's really gone too far by promoting a film full of outrageous anti-Semitic falsehoods. Irving, 30, was suspended by the Nets last week after tweeting a link to Hebrews to Negroes, Wake Up Black America, which falsely blames Jews for the transatlantic slave trade, claims Jews worship Satan, and insists that the Holocaust was exaggerated. This is weapons-grade insanity that will endanger Jews at a time when anti-Semitism is already on the rise. When Irving retreated from defending the film to apologizing under pressure, he outrageously said he should have detailed the specific beliefs in the documentary I agreed with and disagreed with. What part of this nutty film's stupid bigotry do you agree with, Kyrie? Asked Phil Mushnick in the New York Post. Shame on the other NBA stars who declined to condemn him. Imagine how the league would react if a white player publicly attacked black players as literal devils. A hateful theology is entering the mainstream, said Yoon Ji Han in Business Insider. Like Kanye Ye West, actor Nick Cannon and NFL player DeSean Jackson Irving has fallen prey to the teachings of the black Hebrew Israelites, who contend that black people are the true chosen people of God, and that European Jews are devilish imposters seeking world domination. This is deeply alarming stuff, said David Zirin in The Nation. Influential black Americans are adopting beliefs that put them in sick alliance among Nazis, fascists, nationalist, and all manner of white supremacist. Not incidentally, the film Irving promoted to 4.5 million Twitter followers shot to number one among Amazon's documentaries. If all black people are honest with ourselves, said Mike Freeman in USA Today, our community has a terrible blind spot when it comes to Jews. I have heard with my own ears black people echoing ugly anti-Semitic tropes, complaining that Jews were conspiratorial and obsessed with money, controlled the media, and oppressed blacks. This bigotry forgets the long history of Jews and blacks fighting for justice arm in arm. Black people should know as well as anyone the damage done by bigotry and stereotyping. Every Irvin or Yay racist uttering like this chips away at that moral authority we possess. Israel, a hard turn to the right. The Israeli election is a gut punch, said David Myers and Daniel Sokotch in the Los Angeles Times, especially for American Jews who have committed much effort to supporting a progressive vision of Israel. The conservative former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu stormed back into power this week with a far-right coalition of anti-Arab racists that includes the Religious Zionist Party, which garnered the third largest vote share. That party is led by Itamar Ben-Gvir, the avowed disciple of the late hate-filled racist Meir Kahane. Under this coalition, the Jewish state is likely to expand its illegal and immoral occupation of Palestinian land. Ben-Gvir is a dangerous extremist who has called for the deportation of Palestinians and other non-Jewish minorities, said Joshua Leifer in the New York Times. Young Israeli Jews are overwhelmingly right-wing. 70% of them identify as such, compared with 62% of the overall population. It's time to admit that the Israel that many Americans fondly remember for its irreverent secularism and vaguely social democratic ethos no longer exists. Actually, the outraged international press is overreading the results, said the Wall Street Journal in an editorial. Fewer than 10% of Israelis voted for the most radical factions of Netanyahu's coalition, which is more than can be said for many European countries, including Sweden and France. Netanyahu was restored to power because Israelis still trust him for the job of prime minister he has held twice before. They know he will protect the Jewish state from enemies that seek Israel's destruction. The Israeli left, meanwhile, is no longer viable. It lost credibility after the Palestinians refused to accept a state when it was offered and exploited the Israeli military withdrawal from Gaza for attacks on Israeli civilians. Americans can learn one lesson from Israel, how not to stop Trump, said Jason Willick in the Washington Post. Netanyahu is facing trial on corruption-related charges, but it turns out that criminally indicting a political figure doesn't necessarily knock him out. If anything, his win shows how criminal prosecution can bind a leader more tightly to an office, so he can evade conviction and imprisonment. The pull of hard right politics won't be resisted by legal prosecutions or moral indignation, but by realism, triangulation, and leadership. And a couple of short notes. Alcohol-induced deaths, such as from liver disease and pancreatitis, soared 26% in the U.S. in the first year of the COVID-19 pandemic, according to the CDC. There were 49,000 such deaths in 2020 and 52,000 in 2021, up from 39,000 in 2019. 10 of the last 11 recessions started during Republican presidential administrations. 6 of the 7 administrations with the highest job creation rate since World War II were Democratic, and 6 of the 7 administrations with the lowest were Republican. Every Republican president since Ronald Reagan has presided over a 65% or greater expansion of the federal deficit, including Donald Trump, who added $8 trillion to the national debt. And we'll finish with a quote from H.P. Lovecraft, who says, "The oldest and strongest emotion of mankind is fear. And the oldest and strongest kind of fear is fear of the unknown." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you join us again next week. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.